Today is Saturday, September 12th, and this is the World Socialist website. Articles have been read by an automated narration. The record of the New York Times on the war on terror. A quarter century after the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks, the events of that day have passed, for many, from memory to history. About one in three Americans alive today was born after the attacks. With this, the task of the apologists of American imperialism has graduated from propaganda to historical revisionism. The New York Times' editorial board, speaking for the Democratic Party, took up this dirty business in an editorial published Friday. On this 25th anniversary, we ask that America face the mistakes that it made. It wrote, "The mistakes it names are the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the torture of prisoners, and the mass warrantless surveillance of Americans that clearly went too far. The principal legacy of America's response," the New York Times wrote, "is two long bloody wars, one of which in Iraq was started on false pretenses that mostly weakened the United States at home and abroad. The Times names America as the subject of these mistakes in order to absolve any responsibility of specific actors. With everything dissolved into the nation as a whole, no one can be assigned responsibility, let alone criminal liability." The phrase "mistakes were made" was made notorious by President Ronald Reagan, who used it in his State of the Union address of January 27, 1987, to cover up the Iran-Contra scandal, the secret sale of weapons to Iran to finance the Nicaraguan Contras. Serious mistakes were made in trying to do so. The Contras, a force organized and armed by the CIA against Nicaragua's Sandinista government, killed, tortured, and kidnapped civilians, as America's Watch documented in 1984 and 1985, and the International Court of Justice ruled on June 27, 1986, that the United States had violated international law by arming and financing them. As with Reagan's statement on the Iran-Contra scandal, the Times speaks of mistakes in an effort to deflect attention from the fact that it justified and encouraged both the criminal wars of aggression and sweeping attacks on the fundamental constitutional rights of the American people. Its editorial pages justified these actions, and its news section published lies used to sell these mistakes to the public. The Times played the leading role in justifying and promoting the criminal 2003 invasion of Iraq. On September 8, 2002, the paper's lead story was written by reporters Michael R. Gordon and Judith Miller under the headline "U.S. Says Hussein Intensifies Quest for A-Bomb Parts." They reported that Iraq has sought to buy thousands of specially designed aluminum tubes that American officials believed were centrifuge components. It added, "The first sign of a smoking gun, they argue, may be a mushroom cloud." The same morning, Vice President Dick Cheney told NBC's Meet the Press, "There's a story in the New York Times this morning," and cited it as proof that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was seeking tubes for a centrifuge. The administration supplied the claim to the Times, then pointed to the Times as confirmation. On May 26, 2004, in an editor's note titled "The Times in Iraq," the paper conceded coverage that was not as rigorous as it should have been. Stories that depended on Iraqi informants, defectors, and exiles bent on regime change, and editors perhaps too intent on rushing scoops into the paper. The editorial board openly advocated the invasion of Iraq, a criminal war of aggression, giving credence to evidence it knew to be based on lies. On February 6, 2003, it called Secretary of State Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations Security Council the most powerful case to date that Saddam Hussein stands in defiance of Security Council resolutions and a sober factual case against Mr. Hussein's regime. The United States invaded 6 weeks later. The war on terror was accompanied by a frontal assault on democratic rights, of which the systematic illegal torture of prisoners was among the most egregious. The administration of President George W. Bush built a network of secret CIA prisons abroad and tortured the men it held there. And in August 2002, it had the Justice Department write memos declaring the torture legal. The Senate Intelligence Committee reported on December 9, 2014, that the CIA held at least 119 men in these prisons, waterboarded prisoners, kept them awake for up to 180 hours in stress positions, and chained one, partially nude, to a concrete floor until he died of suspected hypothermia. Today, the Times editorial board admits that the United States tortured prisoners, but from 2004 until 2014, the paper consciously, deliberately, and as a stated matter of editorial policy, refused to use the word torture to describe the criminal human rights abuses of the Bush administration, and its Sunday magazine openly justified the administration's policies. On April 28, 2004, CBS broadcast photographs taken by American soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. They showed Iraqi prisoners hooded, stacked naked in a pyramid, held on a leash and made to stand on a box with wires attached to the body, with American soldiers posing beside them. 4 days later, on May 2, 2004, the New York Times Magazine openly advocated the methods it would not call torture in an essay, Lesser Evils, by Michael Ignatieff, Harvard professor and later leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. To defeat evil, we may have to traffic in evils, indefinite detention of suspects, coercive interrogations, targeted assassinations, even preemptive war. These are evils because each strays from national and international law, and because they kill people or deprive them of freedom without due process. For a decade, the Times described waterboarding and the other methods in its news pages as harsh or brutal interrogation methods. It adopted the word torture only on August 7, 2014, after the Justice Department under Bush and Obama had ruled out prosecuting anyone. Executive editor Dean Baquet explained that day that the Times had avoided a label of torture because the Justice Department insisted that the techniques did not rise to the legal definition of torture. On surveillance, the editorial says only that the government used broad new powers to track and monitor Americans and foreigners alike, and that the expansion clearly went too far. The New York Times consistently worked to stop the exposure of mass warrantless surveillance and opposed its publication. It held its own reporter's story on the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping of Americans from before the November 2004 election until December 16th. 2005. On May 22, 2014, in its Sunday Book Review, the Times condemned the publication of the exposure of U.S. government criminality by Edward Snowden and the journalist Glenn Greenwald. In Michael Kinsley's review of Greenwald's account of the National Security Agency files leaked by Snowden in 2013, it declared that the decision to publish government secrets must ultimately be made by the government. Someone gets to decide, and that someone cannot be Glenn Greenwald. The Times' central complaint is that the wars launched under the label of the War on Terror did not succeed in the U.S. goal of dominating the Middle East. For much of the period after the disaster of the Vietnam War, America adhered to its lessons. The Times editorial board writes, "Go to war only with defined and achievable goals. Prevent mission creep. Most of all, win." In this, the Times echoes the Democratic Party's criticism of the Trump administration's war on Iran. Democratic Senator Gary Peters of Michigan put the same demand to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth at a Senate Appropriations Committee hearing on July 21st. "You don't have a strategy. You don't have a long-term plan to actually win this war." Peters demanded that Hegseth win this war. These mistakes were, according to Peters, an utter and complete failure to win this war to this point. The wars, the Times editorial board writes, drained resources that could have been used to strengthen the country against emerging rivals, that is, nuclear-armed China and Russia, which it does not name. Here, the purpose of the exercise becomes clear. The lessons the Times draws from the war on terror are not lessons against war. They are lessons for even greater crimes. This is why the editorial asks America to face the mistakes that it made. The American people did not decide to invade Iraq, to build the CIA's secret prisons, or to wiretap themselves. Those decisions were made by a ruling class, its two parties and its press, including the Times. Not one of the officials who ordered the torture, the editors who printed the lies, or the politicians who voted for the wars has been held to account. The same people, and in many cases the same institutions, have supported the genocide in Gaza, agitated for decades for war against Iran, are demanding the escalation of the war against Russia and preparing the war against China. There is no reckoning with the war on terror that does not begin by naming those responsible for it, and no struggle against the coming wars that does not break with the imperialist Democratic and Republican parties and the entire corporate financial military intelligence establishment that the New York Times speaks for. That reckoning can be carried out only by the working class, mobilized independently and on the basis of its own interests in the United States and internationally. Trump ends fascist convention by calling on attendees to pledge allegiance to him. President Donald Trump capped off the Republican Party's first ever midterm convention in Dallas, Texas, an orgy of fascist reaction, by calling on those in attendance to pledge themselves to him and cheat like hell in the November 3rd elections, less than 2 months away. Ordering the crowd inside the less than capacity American Airlines Center to raise their right hands, Trump, pausing for the audience to repeat each phrase, spelled out the following pledge. Please raise your right hand. I pledge to the greatest president in the history of the United States that loves us so much he can't even breathe, that I will go out with my family, my friends. I'll do it anyway. I don't care if I'm registered or not. I'm going to try and cheat like hell like they do. He later told the crowd that anyone who did not vote would go to hell. Trump's pledge and attack on the elections are not just one-off comments. He and the Republicans are systematically trying to undermine and take control of elections in states across the country. The main line of attack is on mail-in voting. At the same time, Trump's Department of Homeland Security is targeting voter rolls in so-called blue states, seeking to disenfranchise immigrants and citizens who are legally entitled to vote on the basis of the lie that millions of illegals are voting. Trump speaks for an increasingly besieged and unpopular ruling class. Ahead of the November elections, support for Trump and the Republican Party has cratered, with mass anger among millions of workers over the illegal war in Iran, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the war on immigrants, and skyrocketing inflation and inequality. As workers and young people look for alternatives to the two big business parties in capitalism, the corporate oligarchy cultivates fascistic elements. At the Dallas event, nearly every speech featured attacks on immigrants, transgender persons, Muslims and socialists. Before Trump spoke, the convention played a video titled God Made Trump, portraying him as a divinely chosen leader sent to confront the deep state and defend the country. The video began, on June 14, 1946, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker, so God gave us Trump. Trump repeatedly claimed on both nights that the convention was packed and additional supporters were waiting outside. The images inside American Airlines Center told another story. Entire seating sections were covered with tarps, while large portions of the upper level remained empty. The arena, home to the National Basketball Association's Dallas Mavericks and the National Hockey League's Dallas Stars, can accommodate approximately 19,200 spectators for basketball and as many as 21,000 in certain configurations. While official attendance figures have not been released, the Republican National Committee struggled to fill the arena despite offering free tickets to the public. It opened a public ticket lottery in August, and less than a week before the convention, sent unsolicited text messages to Dallas area residents advertising free tickets to see Trump. The sparse attendance came as Trump's approval rating fell to 33% in an August Reuters Ipsos poll. Axios reported before the convention that only about 100 Republican lawmakers and candidates plan to attend, with most battleground district House Republicans staying away. Vice President J.D. Vance addressed the convention, receiving chants of 48 from sections of the crowd, a reference to a prospective presidential run in 2028. Vance smiled and replied, We got to take care of business this November, then we'll worry about what comes next. Tapping into the racist attitudes prevalent throughout the Republican Party, Vance declared early in his speech, "We were tired of being called racist for noticing that our country was becoming dirtier and poorer and less safe and less prosperous." Later, responding to a protester who displayed a Mexican flag, Vance said, "If you love Mexico so much, get your ass over there. I'll buy you the plane ticket." Vance made no direct mention of the U.S. war against Iran, one of the several crises confronting the administration. His only apparent reference came while invoking the purported opposition to war of the assassinated fascist Charlie Kirk. "What I'm asking you to do is do what Charlie did. Do not throw the baby out with the bathwater," Vance said. "Don't give the country over to a bunch of crazy people because you happen to disagree with us on a policy issue here or there." Vance was also silent on Trump's proposed $5,000 bribe to every adult citizen if the Republicans retain control of the House and the Senate in the November elections, seeking to whip up a pogrom-like atmosphere ahead of the 25th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Texas Senator Ted Cruz denounced the Democratic Party, claiming it had been overtaken by a new and dangerous red-green alliance, communists and Islamists. Cruz named New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani and the Democratic Senate nominees in Michigan and Texas. As he spoke, a man in the audience repeatedly called for their assassination. "When Mamdani says he wants to seize the means of production, he means it," Cruz said. "He should be shot," the man yelled. "When Abdul El-Sayed says he has a, quote, obligation to comply with Sharia law, he means it," Cruz continued. "He should be shot," the man shouted again. "And when James Talarico says he wants to dismantle capitalism, he means it," Cruz said. "He should be shot," the man yelled a third time. Cruz did not acknowledge or condemn the death threats. His social media account later posted a video of the speech in which the threats were clearly audible. Cruz, a supporter of Trump's failed January 6th coup, said communists and Islamists were united because they hate Christians, they hate Jews, they hate capitalism, they hate the Constitution, and they hate America. Trump's pledge, including his call for supporters to cheat like hell, and the death threats shouted against three Democratic politicians, came nearly 15 months after the assassination of former Minnesota House Speaker Melissa Hortman. Despite this context, neither incident received prominent treatment on the homepages of several major news organizations Friday afternoon. The New York Times homepage contained two articles about the Republican convention, but neither headline mentioned Trump's pledge or the death threats. ABC News live coverage of the convention, last updated several hours after Cruz spoke, did not mention his speech or the audience member who called for Mamdani, El-Sayed, and Talarico to be shot. This is not a mistake by the major capitalist press, but a deliberate decision to downplay the danger of dictatorship and the threat of fascism. The turn towards fascism in the United States is part of a global process, from the recent election victory of the AfD in Germany to the promotion of fascist Giorgia Meloni in the pages of the New York Times. The ruling class in every country is turning toward far-right reaction. The defense of democratic rights depends on the development of an independent socialist movement of the working class against the financial oligarchy. Socialism 2026 Conference, and the pro-war politics of the Democratic Socialists of America. The Socialism 2026 Conference was held September 4th, 7 in Chicago, organized by Haymarket Books and prominently endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. Its panels promised to discuss the fight for revolutionary socialism, anti-imperialism, and anti-colonialism. Most of the roughly 190 sessions dealt with the concerns of the middle-class pseudo-left: racial identity politics, gender and sexuality, religion and spirituality. But the central political axis of the conference was expressed in its panels on foreign policy, which presented support for the U.S.-NATO war with Russia and the U.S. conflict with China as anti-imperialism. Behind the invocations of anti-imperialism and socialism, stood the pro-war foreign policy of the Democratic Party. At these panels, speakers denounced Russian and Chinese imperialism, whitewashed the Ukrainian government's granting of state honors to perpetrators of the Holocaust, attacked China's zero-COVID policy, and echoed the Trump administration's talking points about China's concentration camps for the Uyghur minority. The Socialism Conference has been held in Chicago annually since 2002. It was founded by the International Socialist Organization, ISO, and passed when the ISO dissolved itself in 2019 to Haymarket Books, which had been the ISO's publishing arm, with the DSA and Jacobin magazine as partners. This year's program was endorsed by more than 90 organizations, among them the DSA, the Tempest Collective, Solidarity New Politics, the Ukraine Solidarity Network, and the Boris Kagarlitsky International Solidarity Campaign. The first of the foreign policy panels came on Saturday when Ashley Smith spoke on the U.S. and China, imperial rivalry in a multipolar world. Smith, a veteran of the ISO and now a leading member of the Tempest Collective, a group formed by former members of the ISO, is a co-author of the Haymarket book China in Global Capitalism and a member of the Champlain Valley chapter of the DSA in Vermont. China and Russia, he said, are up-and-coming predators who exploit their own working class, oppress their own national minorities, oppress oppressed nations in their orbit. On China, Smith made comments that would not be out of place at a State Department press briefing. He called China an imperialist power rivaling the U.S. and said the mass internment of Uyghurs in concentration camps ranks among the greatest crimes against humanity committed by any government. Any socialist that would hold up and praise zero COVID has got to have their head checked, he said of a policy under which China reported about 5,000 COVID deaths in 3 years. The Sunday panel, Russian Neo-Fascism, Imperialism Abroad and Repression at Home, was devoted to the new book, Russia's New Imperialism, Capital and Ideology by Ilya Matveev and Ilya Budryatskis, two Russian academics who left Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. It was sponsored by the Campaign to Free Boris Kagarlitsky, the Russian sociologist jailed for 5 years in 2024 for a social media post about the war. The panel characterized the Russian government as fascist while ignoring and downplaying the Ukrainian government's open promotion and honoring of perpetrators of the Holocaust. Matveev, a political scientist now at the University of Helsinki, dismissed NATO's eastward expansion as a cause of the war with the words, "all these tired arguments." In terms of nuclear balance, there was never a threat to Russia, he said. He complained that before 2022, American support to Ukraine was extremely limited. Budryatskis, a historian who spent the past 2 years as a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, rebuked the room for talking all the way about genocide in Palestine and not talking about this openly genocidal Russian war. When the floor opened, a retired teacher who accused the Ukrainian government of holding thousands and thousands of anti-war prisoners was shouted down by a pro-war attendee who had scratched out his name tag. The teacher, refusing to be intimidated, told the man to shut up and continued his remarks. Asked afterward whether he condemned Ukraine's state honors for Holocaust perpetrators, Budryatsky said he knew of none. When read a list of Holocaust perpetrators honored by the Zelensky government, he refused to comment. Vermont State Senator Tanya Vihovsky was a panelist at the conference's closing day session, The Left and the National Question, Building Solidarity Without Exception. The session was organized by the Ukraine Solidarity Network, alongside University of Chicago sociologist Emin Abdelhadi, Reza Rezaian of the United Iranian Left, and the Venezuelan leftist Simon Rodriguez. A WSWS reporter asked from the floor whether the panelists condemned the honoring of Holocaust perpetrators by the Zelensky government. Vihovsky replied, "Nation states, none of them are free from having done harm." She added, "I can't know everything that's happened, but when it is brought to my attention, I will address it." The Holocaust was placed on the level of the harm done by any state, and its official celebration in Ukraine treated as a detail that had not yet come to her attention. The honors at issue are those bestowed by the Ukrainian state on Stepan Bandera, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUN, and the leaders of the Waffen-SS Galicia Division, Nazi collaborators implicated in the mass murder of Jews and Poles, and today officially designated Ukraine's national heroes. Members and supporters of the Socialist Equality Party distributed leaflets on the case of Bogdan Sirodiuk, the 27-year-old Ukrainian Trotskyist sentenced on August 10th to 15 years in prison for opposing the war and calling on the workers of Russia and Ukraine to unite against it. Among the grounds cited by the court was his reinterpreting the national heroes the panelists had declined to discuss. Amy Goodman, the host of the news program Democracy Now!, and Hassan Piker, the Twitch streamer who headlined the DSA's own panel, refused to make a statement opposing the persecution of Bogdan when asked directly. The context of the conference was a shift to the left among broad sections of workers and young people, triggered by the eruption of imperialist war and the imposition of dictatorship all over the world. This change has led to an increase in the membership of the DSA, which announced in July that it had passed 120,000 members. These layers were overwhelmingly directed to the larger panels, where Piker and Goodman drew audiences in the hundreds. Jokes, banter, and pop culture references gave these sessions the feeling of a stand-up comedy night, while the political discussion was devoted to electoral maneuvers. Piker urged DSA members to volunteer for and endorse Democratic candidates who do not call themselves socialists, holding up as the model the Michigan campaign of Abdul El-Sayed, the former Detroit health director who won the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate on August 4th. Piker campaigned with El-Sayed in April and August. Asked on MSNBC on July 31st why he is not in the DSA, El-Sayed answered, "Because I'm simply not a socialist." Campaigning for such candidates, Piker told the room, is what the DSA is for. Never addressed in these sessions was the fact that the DSA backs and endorses the rapidly escalating U.S. war with Russia. Its two members of Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib, voted for the $40 billion Ukraine war package in May 2022 and the $61 billion package in April 2024. This is the politics of the Democratic Party. The DSA is a faction of that party, and the line laid down in Chicago's breakout rooms is the line of the party that funded the war. The DSA is the political descendant of Max Shackman, who broke with Trotskyism in order to make his peace with American imperialism. In 1940, with Europe at war, Shackman and James Burnham led a minority out of the Socialist Workers' Party, the American Trotskyist Party, refusing to defend the Soviet Union against imperialist attack. Leon Trotsky answered them in defense of Marxism, writing that the minority is leading a typical petty bourgeois tendency that had capitulated to bourgeois public opinion. He insisted the theoretical capitulation would be followed by a political one. Shackman dissolved his Independent Socialist League into the Socialist Party in 1958, backed the CIA's invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and championed the war in Vietnam. He steered his followers into the Democratic Party under the strategy of realignment, and his acolytes ended up in the neoconservative movement. His protege, Michael Harrington, founded the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee in 1973 and merged it with the New American Movement in 1982 to form the DSA. Two other Shackman disciples ran Washington's instruments of regime change: Carl Gershman as president of the National Endowment for Democracy, and Tom Kahn as director of the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Department. In his Letters from Afar of 1917, Lenin called the World War a great stage manager that put every political tendency in its place. The 4 days in Chicago were a demonstration of this. Workers and young people entering into struggle must be warned about the warmongers and reactionaries who staff the upper echelons of the Democratic Socialists of America and determine its politics.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. we urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.